So we are starting with autonomy, and we will begin with a thought experiment, which is both a thought experiment in the sense that it's sort of purely in our minds, but I don't think it's very far away from being reality. You can decide for yourself. So the thought experiment is very simple. We imagine that through some kind of platform like LinkedIn, you could get the perfect job for you, right? You put in all your personal information, your interests, your educational background, previous work history, and so on, all that kind of stuff. And then LinkedIn analyzes that information. And then, of course, because it's a big data sort of optimizer, it will connect your information with, say, information of people you've worked with, the kind of people you tend to get along with, the kinds of trajectories they have. So if you have information about the applicant, which in this case is you, right, your background, your education, your interests and jobs, plus all the information about people you've worked with, and maybe information about family members too, because sometimes brothers and sisters are alike, sometimes they're different, but probably the machine can figure that out too. But if you have this giant network of information, which includes people's interests and strengths and background and so on, then it's very possible that LinkedIn could, with its analytic powers and its ability to understand what kinds of jobs have worked well for other people in the past who are like you, it's very possible that LinkedIn could really provide for you almost a perfect job, right? And then to make this a thought experiment, what we say is, well, let's just imagine that it is a perfect job. Let's imagine that by signing up for LinkedIn, you get the one job which is better than you could find for yourself. Sounds good, right? You go to LinkedIn, give your information, you get the right job. Here's the problem. Here's the catch. The catch is that when you put all of your information into LinkedIn so that they can find the right job for you, that also locates lots of other jobs as being the wrong job, right? So, for example, when I was young, I mean, I could just go knock on a door in a place and say, can I have a job as an insurance salesman, let's say? And when they ask, well, do you have any experience? And I could just sort of make something up, right? Maybe I couldn't make up that I was an insurance salesman, but I could make up something that was sort of going along those lines. And they'd say, okay, and then maybe I could get a job as an insurance salesman. In fact, the whole world was, just 20 years ago, the whole world was pretty much open to you. I mean, no one really could find out about your background beyond the most superficial things, right? Maybe your university degree or most recent job. But beyond that, everyone was a blank slate. Everyone could kind of go and experiment with what they wanted. The catch that we're proposing in this thought experiment is LinkedIn will give you the perfect job, but by the same token, it will disallow you from getting every other job. Why? Because it's not just you, the user, the employee, who has access to the information on LinkedIn. Employers also pay money to LinkedIn in order to see these profiles of employees. And so now, if I go to, let's say, an insurance company and say, look, my name is James, I want to be an insurance salesman, and they ask me, what's your experience? And I make something up. Then the insurance company can go look on LinkedIn and see, look, this Brousseau is full of it. He really hasn't done any of the things he says. So it's a strange situation. On the one hand, LinkedIn is helping me to get the kind of job that is right for me, that's right for my background, my experience, my interests. But at the same time, and by the exact same mechanism, it is denying me the ability to try new things. The ability to go say, look, I've decided I want to be an insurance salesman. I'm just making that up. Maybe it's an accountant or a lawyer or who knows what, right? But all of those things are now sort of out of bounds for me because people at the companies can see, well, Brousseau is not a natural fit for that kind of job. He likes to sit by himself and write and read and work on things. He's perfect for philosophy, but other things, no. So it's odd that on the one hand, LinkedIn seems to promote my freedom, right? It helps me get the kind of job I want. But on the other hand, when you look carefully, it seems as though it takes away quite a bit of freedom too. It takes away from the ability to try something else. So that's the thought experiment. And the question here is, do you sign up? Do you make that deal? You get what you want, the job that's perfect for you, that's better or as good as the one you could find on your own, but you give up the chance to experiment, to find out for yourself, to try new things. I'm not sure what the answer to that is. But that question goes to the heart of what autonomy is, what we will be talking about in this session. So the kinds of questions we're going to ask is, well, what is the value of autonomy? What is it worth? If autonomy is another way of saying personal freedom, or as we were saying on the last slide, the ability to experiment, to try new things, to find out for yourself what the right or wrong job is. If autonomy is some mix of those things, how much is it worth? What will you give up for it? And then another sort of secondary question is, well, how can it be described? That's what we're talking about now. But also, how can it be measured? If you want to ask how wealthy I am, which is not very, you can just go to my bank, right, and look and see there's a number there. That tells you how wealthy I am. If you want to know how tall I am, you can do that too, right? Go to the doctor's office and they've got in a file somewhere in there my height. They know my weight as well. So those things are easy to measure, my wealth, my height, my weight. But how do you measure my freedom? How do you measure how free or how much I am or how much autonomy I have? What are the units? Is it ounces? Is it meters? Is it miles per hour? Right? It's unclear even how we would measure autonomy. So these are some of the questions that intersect with and surround that thought experiment. It's not just the first question, which is, will you take the deal or not? Will you give up the chance to experiment in order to get the perfect job? It's also, what exactly are you giving up? Does this example capture part of autonomy or personal freedom? Does it capture all of autonomy and personal freedom? What exactly is it capturing? And then, insofar as we have some idea of what it is, how do you measure it? With what units? These are the kind of questions we will be looking at in this session. So what I propose is that in the first part of the session, we talk about the definition of autonomy. And first, we will ask ChatGPT, because we never know when we might get a good answer there. And then we'll look at a philosophical definition of autonomy, and then a philosophical social definition of autonomy, and then a more practical definition. All right, so let's look. I've got the ChatGPT here pulled up for us. I should have typed the question in, but I will now. What is autonomy in AI ethics? Let's say in 50 words? In 50 words. 50 words or less. Let's see what ChatGPT-4 has for us. Okay. Autonomy and AI ethics refers to the principle that AI systems should enhance and respect human autonomy. All right, well, that's autonomy means that we should enhance and respect human autonomy. Okay, so that first sentence, you can see this is classic ChatGPT. It sounds like it's telling you something, but it's not telling you anything. Autonomy, essentially, ChatGPT is saying autonomy is autonomy. And that's gone. Ensuring that individuals maintain control over decisions that affect them. Okay, that's better. So autonomy for ChatGPT is control over decisions that affect you. Autonomy emphasizes the importance of consent, privacy, and the ability to intervene or opt out of AI-driven processes. Okay, good. So the second parts are a little better. So ChatGPT is defining autonomy as control over decisions that affect you. That's a good start. And it is significantly intersects with consent. This is something that would this would fit well to in medical ethics. And all of us have had the experience of talking with doctors and having doctors spit out some crazy jargon that no one can understand. If a doctor recommends that you have a certain treatment or a certain test or so on, part of being free, part of having autonomy as a patient is being able to consent to those things, to say, yes, I want this test. Yes, I want this treatment, as opposed to just falling victim to some discussion the doctor gives and you don't understand what's going on, but you know you're supposed to come back in 2 weeks for something, right? So consent is that. Privacy is, we're going to talk about that specifically in a few weeks. The inability to intervene or opt out of AI-driven processes, that makes sense, right? You can say, I want to be part of, in this LinkedIn, I mean, I think most all of us agree that we have some significant amount of autonomy with respect to LinkedIn. It might be that in the future, people will feel like they have to be on LinkedIn, but I think it's still true that you can get away with not being on LinkedIn, that you have the ability to opt in or opt out of LinkedIn. The question we were asking back in that thought experiment is, well, I mean, is LinkedIn helping our autonomy or not? But whether or not we have the autonomy to be on LinkedIn, yes, I think we do have that for the moment. Anyway, all right, so that's ChatGPT. I suppose if I was going to highlight something, I would say individuals maintain control over decisions that affect them. That's a good start, control over your own decisions. I think that's pretty obvious, but it's something. Let's now look at the more philosophical definition of autonomy, or as I say here, other kinds of, they're not exactly synonyms, but they're words that overlap significantly with autonomy. There's the idea of freedom or personal freedom, the idea of self-determination, the idea of agency. All those ideas can be defined philosophically, with really very properly within the idea of autonomy as giving law to yourself. That's where the idea of self-determination comes from, right? That you determine for yourself, which is not quite that you have control over decisions. It's that you can, is that you determine for yourself almost what the decisions are. And then more importantly, the second idea that there's the notion of self-determination or giving law or rules to yourself exists theoretically between two extremes. On one side, you can imagine an existence with no rules. That was, in a sense, that sounds like it's purely free, but it's not. If there's no rules at all, if nothing governs what I am doing or my intentions or where I go, and if there's no rules at all, nothing saying like I want to obey the traffic laws when I'm driving, or I want to try to get something to eat when I'm going to the supermarket, or I want to get to class because I have to teach in 2 hours or some such, or 20 minutes. If there's no rules at all, right? There's no traffic rules. There's no clock rules telling me when I have to be somewhere. If everything is just chaos, well, that's not freedom. That's just randomness, right? I mean, if there were literally no rules, no time when I had to be somewhere, no rules about how, even how you would get from, I live in Brooklyn, to go to downtown Manhattan, right? It's a very easy and quick trip, but if there was no rules, right? If north meant south or west meant east, but then west meant south, if everything was completely random, I could never possibly even get to campus. And as I say, if there's no rules for time, if 4 o'clock comes after 5 o'clock and after 7 o'clock, but before 3 o'clock, everything makes no sense. So it's important to understand that the idea of no rules at all is not freedom. Freedom does not mean the absence of rules. It does not mean escaping from rules. The absence of rules or escaping rules means just craziness, randomness. It means nothing. It's just you're like a mindless whirligig, right? Floating through the universe with no direction, no intention, no meaning, no purpose. Right? That's not freedom. That's just silliness. So that's on one side. The idea of self-determination or autonomy or giving rules to yourself, right, does not mean no rules. It means there are rules, but you give them to yourself, as opposed to at the other extreme, right? One extreme is no rules. The other extreme is other people impose rules upon you, right? That's also a lack of freedom. So you don't have freedom when people are forcing me, telling me I must be at Pace University at 2 o'clock today, regardless of what I want or what my own purposes in life are or what my responsibilities are or what obligations I have chosen for myself. Autonomy is that last part. Autonomy is the idea that I have obligations that I have chosen for myself. When I have obligations that other people choose for me, when they say, Bruce, oh, you've got to be at Pace at 2 o'clock, well, then I lose self-determination. That's a loss of freedom. That's a loss of agency, and that's a loss of autonomy. So, wrapping this up, importantly, the definition of autonomy or personal freedom or self-determination is the idea that you give law or give rules or give determination to yourself. And it's between the extremes of having no rules, which is chaos, and having the rules imposed upon you by someone or something else. Okay. So that's the definition of autonomy. You can see that I asked Dali to give us a visual rendition of what autonomy is, or personal freedom. And actually, and if you look at it and you have an idea of what autonomy really is, then the image actually sort of makes sense, right? There's these two lines here. And the man, the man standing forward facing this bright light. But you can see right at his feet, there are the line veering off to the right and the line veering off to the left. And that kind of captures the idea, right? That autonomy is up this middle way. It's between these extremes of at one extreme having no rules, which is craziness, and at the other extreme being suffering some kind of slavery, having others impose rules upon you. So that's autonomy. And I think that image is not bad. So Dali produced a decent image of what autonomy means. I think the Dali image of autonomy is better than the ChatGPT textual definition. Okay, so that's the philosophy definition of autonomy. Now we can also think about autonomy or personal freedom in a more social sense. That is, not just me alone, but me in the world. And when we think of autonomy in the social sense, then personal freedom or autonomy as an ethical stand is the idea of freedom maximization. That is, or autonomy maximization, which is basically you can do whatever you want, which means that you can rule yourself. You can give whatever rules you like to yourself up to the point where what you are doing interferes with others doing what they want to do, right? Or in other words, up to the point where the rules that you impose upon yourself inhibit or block other people from giving rules to themselves, right? So it's fine for me to shadow box, right? To kind of dance around my living room going like this and that kind of thing. Perfect freedom. I'm giving rules to myself. Maybe I do this to exercise, right? So my purpose is to stay in good shape, and the way I enjoy exercising is by shadow boxing against the wall. And so I give this rule to myself that every day from 10:30 to 10:45, I shadow box against the wall. Great, no problem. The problem comes when I decide to go out on a crowded sidewalk and do my shadow boxing, right? And you can imagine I start banging against the chins of the poor passersby. The problem with that, the technical problem with respect to autonomy, is not that I'm swinging my fists around the air. The problem is that my free actions are interfering with the freedom of others to give rules or laws to themselves, right? The person who's walking down the sidewalk because they're exercising their self-determination to go to the grocery store has that self-determination blocked when I hit them on the chin and knock them out, right? So The idea of autonomy or personal freedom in a social context is this idea that we're free to do whatever we want up to the point where our personal freedom, the things that we are doing, interfere with the others' ability to do the same, others' ability to be free in their actions and to give purposes to themselves and to give and to live within a realm of self-determination with respect to their own activities and purposes. So that would be the idea of autonomy socially. And then one sort of experiment that people, or I'm not sure it's an experiment so much, but it's a kind of a conundrum that people like to think about, is this question about whether or not, I mean, in some sense, whether or not it's possible to be truly free if you are living in a world with other people. We remember this childhood story, the story of Robinson Crusoe, who was left alone on the island in the Caribbean for how long? Who lived 28 years on an uninhabited island, according to the story, right? So the question is, well, does he have perfect autonomy? I mean, it seems like he can maximize his freedom because he never has to limit his own self-determination in order to make room for other people to live in the way they want to. But then on the other hand, it's also true that if no one is around at all, if you're just by yourself, I'm not sure what kind of freedom that is. I mean, to a certain extent, we value our freedom. We want to have self-determination when we are surrounded by others and when we contrast ourselves with others. When we say, look, there's a certain kind of job that I want, going back to the LinkedIn example, there's a certain kind of job that I want and that suits my purposes and interests and strengths, but it's different than the kind of job you want, right? And then when you're competing for the same job, right, then that's where autonomy kinds of questions can become very sharp. Let's say that you and I are competing for the same job, but I happen to know something about you. I know that you are, I'm just making something up. I know that you are an alcoholic and you get drunk every day at lunchtime. I'm not saying you personally, I'm just making this up. My competitor, I mean, for this job. And so now I have this question, right? We're both competing for the same job. I'm certainly have the self-determination, the autonomy, the freedom to say, look, my competitor is a drunk, right? No doubt. But when I'm doing that, am I impinging upon the freedom of my competitor? That is my self-determination interfering with his or her self-determination? I'm not sure exactly what the answer to that is, but this segment of the discussion is to ask the larger question, and maybe it's only in those kinds of situations that we have a sense of our own freedom and our own self-determination. In other words, maybe it's only, we only kind of feel free when our freedom is limited. So I'm not sure if you imagine yourself, I don't want to do this experiment personally, but if you imagine yourself on an island alone for 28 years, I'm not sure you would be free. Maybe in some purely theoretical sense, but would the human experience of freedom be there, or would you just sort of feel like you were living in a place where there was no, it would be almost a place where there's no freedom and not no freedom, where the question of freedom doesn't even come up. It's like living in a desert. There's no water there. So it's not a question of whether you like the beach or don't like the beach. There are no beaches. Right? It's not a question. You're just in the desert. It's kind of like that here for freedom, I think, in Robinson Crusoe. It's not that he's really free. It's that there's just no question about freedom. It doesn't come up. It's not part of his reality. It seems to me that might be right, that being alone, perfectly alone, would not be freedom, but it would not be the opposite of freedom either. It would just be a non-freedom reality, like being in a desert and it has nothing to do with the beach because there's no ocean. Anyway, that's something we could think about later. The main point I want to make here is this idea that within a social setting, one of the things that's interesting about autonomy or personal freedom is that freedom itself is limited or constrained. Excuse me. Freedom is limited or constrained by freedom itself. So freedom limits freedom, right? Because as I say, I'm free to do whatever I want up to the point where my freedom interferes with your freedom to do whatever you want, right? So it's a curious situation that freedom limits freedom, or freedom constrains freedom, or autonomy is circumscribed by autonomy. Autonomy defines itself. That would be the way to say it. Okay. So that's the philosophical definition, the social definition, and then in the practical world, there's also a set of ways of thinking about autonomy. And those the three key ideas, and here I've got Dali going again for us, are the idea that in order to be free or to have autonomy, you must be physically free. That is, that means just that I'm not, someone does not have me handcuffed to a chair. If I'm handcuffed to a chair, I have lost my autonomy because I can't go anywhere. That's the most obvious practical definition of autonomy. But autonomy also normally is taken to imply a kind of mental freedom, which is informational freedom. So if I want to go to the grocery market, but some evil person at Apple puts into my phone, Google Maps, some evil manipulator at Google changes the Google Maps, and now everything is reversed, and so I can never find the grocery store. I'm not really free, or don't really have self-determination. I cannot exercise my autonomy because the rule I've given to myself is I want to go to the grocery store to buy some hamburgers, but I can't do that because I don't know where the grocery store is. Or even worse, I think the grocery store is east, but really it's west. So in order to have freedom, or in order to have autonomy, it's not enough to just be physically free. We also need at least some minimal level of true information about our existence, our world, our surroundings, what other people are thinking and doing, and so on. We can't be free if we don't know anything. So that's the second side of the triangle of practical freedom. And then the third side is psychologically reasonable. Another way that we frequently, or I'm not sure frequently, but another way that somewhere in the world is frequent that someone is losing their freedom is psychologically, in the sense that their minds are not working well, or their minds are, in a sense, short-circuiting in the way your mind would be short-circuited if you are, it has happened to many people, that people get drunk and then they do or say things that they would not normally do or say as drugs become more penetrating or more severe, like psychological drugs or psychedelic drugs and so on, right? Our ability to be psychologically reasonable, our ability to understand the world diminishes, and that too diminishes our freedom. So just like we need to be free, we need to be freed of constraints. I can't be handcuffed to a chair. We also need to be free in terms of information. I need to know some basic things about the world. And finally, my brain itself must be functioning in ways that seem that are fairly normal. If I'm hearing voices in my mind, right, telling me quickly go to the grocery store and buy 40 pounds of bananas, I'm not sure that I have autonomy or personal freedom in that situation. Right? It seems as though if my mind is not working well, then in some sense I'm not acting freely. And then, of course, we see this in law. If someone drives drunk and gets in an accident, at least in some jurisdictions, you're not charged with murder or manslaughter in that case because you were not in your right mind. though there might be equal penalties for driving drunk and for causing this kind of accident, so you end up in jail for the same amount of time, but you're not technically charged for murder or manslaughter because you weren't psychologically reasonable. You were drunk. You weren't thinking clearly. So those, in practical terms, if we have the philosophical definition of freedom as self-determination, if we have the social definition of freedom as free to do whatever I want up to the point where it blocks others from doing what they want, and now we have a kind of a practical set of ideas, which is we have to be physically free, mentally informed, and psychologically reasonable. And then we, just as a quick, just I will put in a very quick example here. This is from an actual research paper from, I guess, 2015, but the rules haven't changed since then. It was a study of autonomy as it exists for in health and well-being applications on the phone, meaning these kinds of apps you have which tell you what you need to do, some exercise, you need to eat this or that, or you need to take a walk, or maybe you should take a nap, and so on. There are all kinds of, and every day there are more of them, these health and well-being apps, and we could ask the question, well, do these applications, I mean, how much autonomy do they grant the user? And so in this article, the authors say, look, we can think about that in terms of the degree of control that the user has within the app. So that would be something like, can I change in, if it's a health and well-being app, can I change the goals that I have for my, let's say my weight? Uh-oh, it's after Christmas time. So I was aiming to be at 190 pounds average weight this year, but I'm going to start out at 210. So I better adjust the average up a little bit for the year. Well, can I do that in the application? Something like that would be the degree of control that the user has within the app. And I think something like that corresponds a little bit with the physical the physical idea of freedom. Then there's the degree of personalization over the app's functionality. So that would be maybe it turns out that for some people, we'll just stick with losing weight because why not? Maybe for some people, you know, one kind of diets, like there's the high protein. I mean, every week there's some new idea, right? There's the high protein diet will work, or maybe you just eat a lot of lettuce and carrots, or maybe drink water without stopping, that kind of thing. Who knows? So the degree of personalization would be, you know, to what extent can I make the weight loss sort of algorithm work in accordance with my own way of losing weight? That is, with a high protein diet, or with lots of water, or lots of carrots, you know, what have you. I think that's also kind of like the physical idea of freedom. Then there's this idea of the mental or information freedom, which is the degree of truthfulness and reliability related to the information presented to the user and how it affects their decisions. Right. So this is just, I mean, if the app is, it has the right information about weight loss. I mean, if, again, I'm trying to lose weight and the application says, and chocolate chip cookies will help, eat lots of those. Well, you know, that's then I have lost my freedom or my autonomy, my ability to control and give rule to myself because I'm eating lots of chocolate chip cookies thinking this is going to help me lose weight. It's not my fault. I have lost autonomy, personal control, because I'm being given bad information by the app. And then the next point that they evaluate in this article is users' own self-understanding. Regarding the goal pursuit and whether the app promotes or hinders the user's awareness of their own agency. That is, maybe the app might say something like, whisper something, actually, no one can control their weight, so don't worry too much about that. That's not exactly informational loss. That's more like psychological. It almost makes you drunk because it messes up with the way your mind processes reality and something like that. I think that's more of a psychological loss of autonomy than it is mental or informational. And then whether the app promotes some form of moral deliberation or moral values and actions it recommends, that is whether or not it gives you some self-consciousness of why you want what you want and whether it confuses you there or not. So I think that too is almost psychological. It's almost like if you're getting wrong, if you're getting steered in the wrong direction with respect to why you want to lose weight, this is just a trivial example, but I think it serves. If you're being steered in the wrong direction about why you want to lose weight on some philosophical level, then perhaps the app is distorting your mind in a way that's kind of like alcohol or a drug. But it's not clear. As you can see, part of the reason I use this example is when you do it theoretically, as I do it here, I mean, it all makes sense, right? Perfectly clear. Yeah, right. But then when you actually do it in the real world, in something just as simple as an application on your phone, that, as I'm saying, we imagine kind of a weight loss application. When you just do it something simple in the real world, then all of a sudden, it becomes really complicated. It's hard to distinguish, well, is this really a physical, the degree of control the user has, is this really kind of like a physical thing, or is this more of a mental thing, or is it more psychological? And then the same thing with the later ones. It's not clear if they're psychological or mental. It's really hard in the real world to, in many situations, to determine exactly in what ways our autonomy or our ability to give rules to ourselves, to self-determination, to determine for ourselves what our purposes are. It's very difficult, or it can be very difficult, to determine exactly what things are helping us, encouraging or making more robust or embellishing our autonomy, and which things are taking away. And then that goes all the way back to the LinkedIn experiment. And I think that's the kind of the big idea that we're trying to get at here. It's not just that, of course, the specifics are, we need those to go forward. We need a specific definition of what autonomy is. But the big idea with respect to the study of this subject is it's really hard to tell sometimes whether or not things in the world are helping us to be more free or taking away from our freedom. And that question, which has always existed for humanity, becomes it seems to me, is going to be pressed very hard by advances in technology and artificial intelligence. Okay, so we have some technical stuff, some practical stuff, and now I want to talk about the experience of autonomy. This gets back to the question we asked at the start. Well, what is autonomy worth? You know, why do we want it? And maybe this is, if the big conceptual question or the hard conceptual question is, does something help our autonomy and self-determination, or does it hurt our autonomy and self-determination? That's the big conceptual question. The big ethical question is, well, why do we want autonomy? I mean, is autonomy worth having? Is it good? How good is it? We talked a little at the start about measuring it. It's really hard to measure. Even what is the experience of autonomy? And so I've tried to think about that quite a bit, actually. So what is the experience of autonomy and what is it worth? We could spend the entire semester just right on that question. But we'll just have this one slide. And this is just a scene from New York City. Many of us have seen this. The tourists come to town and they're vaguely lost and want to find the World Trade Center or something, Oculus or what have you. And you see them lost, and maybe you're even standing next to them on the corner waiting for the light, and you hear them saying, well, where is the Oculus? Must be here. Must be there. No, left. No, right. Right. And of course, if you live here, then you know exactly where the Oculus is, right? No, it's not left or right. It's behind you. You could just tell them that, right? Easily. Easy. And I guess everyone will have to think about this experience for themselves. But I myself... even though that has happened to me, I mean, for anyone who goes to PACE, that happens, has to happen regularly, that you're just standing on the corner and you're hearing tourists saying, got to get to the oculist. One says it's left, the other says it's right. And you know, right now, that it's just behind them. It's neither one. You're very tempted just to say, guys, actually, it's not left or right. It's just behind you. Look, you can see it. It's right over there. Look, there it is. But I myself, I mean, I don't see that. I just let them struggle. And I don't think it's because I am a sadist, or I don't think it's because I'm cruel or want them to suffer. I think it's because that when people visit New York or anywhere, part of the fun, and I think part of the experience of being free in New York City is finding these places for yourself, right? It's there is some sense in which you're giving rule to yourself, or you're exercising your own self-determination when you set up this purpose of finding something and going to see it. And then you struggle and wrestle with the maps and all that, and then you get there for yourself. I think that giving people what they want, you know, just saying, "Look, it's right behind you. There's the Oculus right there." It sounds like you're being helpful, and maybe you are, and in some ways, of course, you are. Right? They're looking for it. You can tell them where it is. There's nothing wrong with telling people where the Oculus is. But I think that it goes against their autonomy, their ability to decide and determine themselves. Sort of like in that first example of LinkedIn. I mean, getting what you want is not exactly autonomy. I mean, getting what you want can almost be a kind of a lack of self-determination. When I just tell them, look, it's behind you, there it is. In some sense, I take all the fun out of it, right? It's like, oh, we were having... Even though they look like they're suffering, they're not really. They go to a foreign place, and part of the fun, as I say, is to find your north and your south, and find the things struggling with the maps. So you kind of take that away from them when you tell them where the Oculus is. I'm not sure about that, though. It seems like a close call, but my sense is that there's some connection between that and autonomy and personal freedom, and that when you tell them where the Oculus is, you're taking away from their autonomy and personal freedom by giving them, paradoxically, when you give them what you want, you take away their freedom. But I'm not sure. So there's a lot to think about there. But I think the experience of the tourist lost in New York and struggling with the map is a lot like the experience of LinkedIn from the beginning. And there's something very seductive about getting what you want. I mean, of course there is. We all want to get what we want. That's why we want things. That's why we try and get them. But getting what you want can be a loss of your ability to determine for yourself, find for yourself. And then wrapping this up, we were asking, well, what is the value of autonomy? What is the experience of it? I think that one way to talk about the value of it, or why we want it, is because of the fun these tourists are having. That's what autonomy looks like. Maybe it doesn't look like fun like laughing at jokes and drinking beer and that kind of fun. It's not that kind of fun. But it's a different kind of enjoyment or contentment, right? The enjoyment or contentment of being lost and finding the Oculus for yourself, as opposed to having someone to stand there and tell you, no, it's here, right? Kind of impose it upon you. I think giving people what they want is a kind of imposition. It's almost a kind of slavery. It's a good slavery, maybe, right? You're getting what you want in it. But you're still losing your ability to find it for yourself, to live for yourself. And the experience of doing that, I think, is like the experience of these tourists. And it's not fun in the sense of jokes and laughter. It can even make you irritable and angry. Like it happens a lot of time. You see the couples, and they end up fighting left, right, that kind of stuff. Divorce time. So it's not even happy. I don't think autonomy is necessarily even happy. But still, people keep going to New York and Paris and different places and try to find their own way. And I think the part of the reason is because they want to be, they want self-determination. They want to find, they want to give rules to themselves. They want to determine for themselves how they will get to this place. And so I think something like that is the experience of autonomy. Something that is, like that is what autonomy feels like. Okay. So, all right. We've done, I think that's a good start. We have done a lot. We have done a kind of a definition of autonomy. Well, we've done, first we did the thought experiment, the LinkedIn. Then we did the definition of autonomy philosophically, which is giving rules to oneself. Then we did a definition of autonomy that was a theoretical. Then we did it socially. Which is this idea that it's freedom maximized or limited, freedom limited by freedom, or the idea that I'm free to do whatever I want up until the point where what I'm doing interferes with you being free to do what you want. Then we looked at some practical kinds of things, and then we finished by looking at this, kind of the experience of autonomy. And so now maybe we can just take a few minutes for each of you to imagine your own experience of autonomy. I've given you a lot of information, but with real things, when you're studying something that's actually real, it's not just information and stuff. It's when you're actually studying real stuff, one way you know you're studying something that's real is that it's hard to figure out exactly what it is you know. So I will ask you just to take a few minutes to think about what exactly it is that you've learned or what autonomy means for you. And there's no right or wrong answer, of course. Though for a test or something, you can always get some analytically right or wrong answer. You can say, well, what is the philosophical definition of autonomy? Is to give rule to yourself. But that's only a part of it. I don't think that there's any actual end to the discussion or to thinking about what autonomy means. But I will give you 5 minutes anyway to think about it. Okay, so the next subject to discuss is autonomy always important? If we're saying that autonomy, and we are saying that autonomy is valuable, is something that's worth having, then the obvious question is, okay, maybe it's worth having sometimes, like when you're looking for the Oculus or something, but is it always worth having? Is it always important? And I have a slightly different thought experiment here. This is, it's very related, I think, to the LinkedIn experiment. And it's an experience, I think, that all of us have had, maybe not specifically with this television show or this streaming provider, but whether it's TV or Spotify music or something else, we all come into contact with predictive analytics, right? With artificial intelligence, which suggests to us or recommends for us what the next fill in the blank movie, song, etc., restaurant, and so on, what the next movie, song, restaurant is that we should look at, listen to, visit. That's what predictive analytics and AI, that's one of the things that AI does. And in the field of predictive analytics, I think that's the main thing it does, is that it recommends things to us, that the machine recommends things to us that it thinks we will like. And so in this case, I'm not sure if any one of you have seen this detective show called Poirot. This is an Agatha Christie character. It's kind of an intriguing detective series. This kind of funny character. This is the detective. It's both sort of interesting and kind of funny at the same time. He goes around and solves kind of like, he's kind of a French Columbo figure. He solves mysteries in his own way. And then, of course, it's a limited series. At some point, they stop making the shows. And so you go from season 3, episode 1, 2, 3, 4, season 4, episode da, da, da. I mean, at some point, you get to the end of the Poirot series, right? And then Netflix has a problem. For Netflix, it's really easy. If you've been watching Poirot season 1, episodes 1 through 5, and then season 2, episodes 1, 2, right? They've got a pretty good idea of what you suggest after episode 2, right? They just go right into episode 3. The hard part for Netflix comes when the Poirot episodes run out. Now we've seen seasons 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. There's no more Poirot. They've got to suggest something else if they want to keep me in front of the television. And Netflix wants that, right? That's what they understand their job to be, to keep me stationed on my sofa watching the screen. So how are they going to do that? Well, the first thing they do is the same thing they've been doing up to now, which is before this series episode even ends, or just as it's ending, it's very precise, just as it's ending, they're already rolling the next episode, right? This is true. Was true through all the, we'll just imagine that we all watched together the Poirot season. This was certainly true for the entire Poirot season, that as soon as season 3, episode 2 was coming to an end, before it fully ended, and certainly before they started running the credits, they were already showing in the corner the very start of the next episode. So we were never really broke away from Poirot. As soon as our interest had culminated and we were about to say, well, maybe I should go wash the dishes or something, who knows, right? Maybe I should go do something else. Just at the moment that idea would pop into our mind, that the new episode starts. And so we're already thinking, oh, what's going to happen now? Who's going to, since it's Poirot, probably, unfortunately, someone is going to die. And so we're interested to see who that victim is going to be and why and how and that stuff. And so theoretically, we can't ever escape the television. So that's the way it works. That's what predictive analytics does. It's fine. But the challenge they have at Netflix is, what, after Poirot is done, what do they put? And then another series, which is kind of similar, I think, but different, is this one called Shetland, which is about also a sort of idiosyncratic and curious detective. But instead of being in, I think Poirot is Paris, right? But he kind of is in Europe all over. He's kind of like James Bond, but funny. He's all over Europe. Shetland is this guy in Ireland or something like that. A very different kind of character, very salt of the earth kind of character. But if you like idiosyncratic detectives solving odd crimes, which Poirot is, then Netflix tells me that I will also like this Shetland character, or this show called Shetland. I think that, I can't remember if Shetland is the place where he is, or it's his name, or both. I don't know. But I know that I did get recommended Shetland. That's why I put it here. And so how does it work, right? Just as the last episode of Poirot is ending, you see it starts in 0 second. In 0 seconds, you see it at the bottom, it starts in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, right? And then it's going. And so once again, you're stuck. You can't get away from Poirot. So that's the way predictive analytics works. There's autonomy dilemma. It's very similar to the LinkedIn. Is our freedom, is our self-determination being facilitated or helped by this, or are we being trapped? Are we being imprisoned by this? I mean, is Netflix helping us be more free, or is it making us be less free? I'm not sure what the answer is, but what I wanted to talk about in this system, in this part of the discussion, is not just more or less freedom, but as I said at the start of this section, does freedom always matter? I mean, it's one thing, for example, to worry about freedom in a kind of a healthcare setting. I think almost all of us agree that if you're making a decision about a major life decision, like, let's say, I'm just making this up again. Am I going to go in for some major surgical procedure because they think there might be, a problem with my heart, so they're going to do some major surgical procedure on my heart. But of course, if it's a procedure like that, maybe I would die. Hopefully not, right? So this is a major decision, right? I'm literally risking my life to save my life. And I think most all of us agree that we should have self-determination. We should be free to make that decision for ourselves. And the question of autonomy or personal freedom is very important to that. But what about this for Netflix? I mean, even if we say, and this is the point I want to make, even if we say that Netflix is really imprisoning us, is kind of trapping us in front of the TV, it's exploiting the knowledge it has of our interests, it's exploiting the fact that they know that I like Perot to tempt me with this new series and keep me trapped in front of the TV, even if we say that this is an assault on my autonomy, even if we say that my autonomy is being radically limited or being constrained by these evil people at Netflix because they're forcing me to watch these TV shows, then we might say, well, wait a minute now. Even if it's true that Netflix takes away my personal freedom, and I'm not sure they do, but let's just say they do. Even if we say that, does it really matter? And that is autonomy always equally important? Certainly it's important when we're talking about healthcare, major healthcare decisions. But when we're just talking about watching movies, does autonomy matter? Does it have the same value? Is autonomy something like, let's say sort of like pregnancy, right? You're either pregnant or you're not, right? There's kind of no middle ground. It's zero or one. I mean, so is autonomy like that? Like something you have or you don't have? Or is autonomy something more like grains of sand, right? You can have a little bit of autonomy, one or two grains of sand, or you can have a lot of autonomy, sort of a whole beach. So if autonomy is the second, if it's like sand, right, then we might say, look, healthcare decisions are kind of like beaches. There's a lot of autonomy involved there, a lot of sand, a lot of it. We have to worry about that quite a bit. But movies is more like just one or two bits of sand. And if we leave the beach with one or two bits of sand and stomp those into the street, it really doesn't matter. And there's so much sand on the beach that who cares, right? If movies are like that, right, or rather if autonomy is like sand, then maybe we would say that movies are kind of like one or two grains of sand. And so autonomy really doesn't matter too much. And so we really don't need to bother too much about these ethical questions or the ethical question of personal freedom when it comes to Netflix, whereas we do need to worry about it when it comes to health decisions. By contrast, that's one way of thinking. By contrast, the other way of thinking is that autonomy is not like that. It can't be divided up. It's not like grains of sand. There's a beach of it, a little bit of it. Instead, autonomy is like, again, it's like pregnancy, right? Or it's like zero and one. You either have it or you don't. Or maybe autonomy is kind of, in a sense, like air, right? You can't really divide it up. You either have air or you don't, which is bad. So if autonomy is like that, if it's not divisible, it's something you have or you don't have, well, then in that case, then we have to be worried about the Netflix thing. So this is an important debate within autonomy. Is autonomy something, or personal freedom something, we should worry about all the time, or only sometimes? So that's that. So we have the LinkedIn, where I think it's pretty clear that autonomy is important there, because that's our professional life, our job. Then we have a similar question here, which is Netflix. And I'm not sure here that it matters as much. Some people say yes, some people say no. And then a third example, say Tinder. So have the same, this is also predictive analytics, whether it's LinkedIn predicting the right job for you or Netflix predicting the movie that you should watch. Dating apps do the same thing. They predict the right choice, or they try to predict the right choice for your romantic matchups. We could think here too, and just quickly create the same thought experiments in your minds. If this is the way the experiment would be, if Tinder or Match or whatever app could give you the right pairing, right? The person who would be the best one for you, better than the one you could find in your own life, as good or better than one you could find in your own life, would you take that pairing if it meant that you couldn't experiment with or try dating anybody else? Right, just the same thing with the LinkedIn. And if Tinder knows you perfectly, let's just imagine that I'm single and I'm looking to get married, and Tinder knows me perfectly, and Tinder comes to me and says, look, Brousseau, we have your big profile, and there's this woman, Sarah Jones. I hope there's not a Sarah Jones in this class. There is, just made it up. Sarah Jones is the perfect woman for you. Once you sign up for Tinder, you know, the two of you are matched up, and then let's just imagine it's, you're legally required to marry each other and you're together, but it's good. It's good because Tinder works. It makes you happy. The guarantee I'm giving is that Sarah Jones really is as good or better match than I would ever find in my own life, right? She's perfect for me, let's say. Now, would I take that deal if it meant that I could never date anybody else? Let's just, you could go out to the extreme and say, imagine I could never in my life have ever dated anyone. It's just when you turn 18 or 21 or whatever age you decide. This is just a thought experiment. Whatever age you decide, you're matched up with this one person. It's the perfect person. And off you go to live together and you're happy. No married couple is ever perfectly happy, but you're as happy as you could possibly be as a couple forever. Great. Okay. I mean, that's pretty tempting, right? And that sounds pretty good. If you could be as happy as possible romantically forever, that's a big reward. But the cost is also pretty high too, right? The cost is that you can't find out for yourself. The cost is that you can't experiment with other matches and so on. So the question is there, again, would you take that deal? That's a basic autonomy question. Does Tinder in that case give you autonomy or not? Part one of the question. But then part two of the question is it different? And your lifelong personal partner match, and that's a big deal. That's a lot. It tells you a lot about how successful and rewarding your life is going to be. It's probably, I hope, it's a lot more important than what movies you're going to watch, right? So the question is, for maximum case like Tinder, is that also maximum autonomy? That is that where autonomy is most valuable? And then in Netflix, where it's less valuable? Or is autonomy, personal freedom, self-determination, one of those things that's the same regardless? It's equally important even when the stakes are relatively trivial. It's equally important whether we are talking about Netflix movies or lifelong romantic partners. And again, there's no answer. Like, we're talking about real stuff now, which means there's no answers to the questions. But asking the question itself is what is significant. And so that's where I want to leave that thought. I will show you in my classes. In my undergraduate classes, I always ask this question of the people on one of the tests. Not in this class now because I've given it away, but I usually do that and then reveal afterwards. And here are the results. I always ask them on the test, well, do you go yes or no for those three choices? And you can see that among PACE students, at least undergraduate students, in general, the answers are people do not take the deal. They do not want the movies to be picked for them. Again, for the Netflix, the idea of the dilemma is simply that Netflix will always give you exactly the movie you want, but you will lose the ability to scroll for yourself and choose your own movies. So that would be the Netflix deal. You always get the right movie, but you cannot scroll for yourself. For jobs, the idea is you will get the perfect job for you, but you can't experiment with anything else. And then for a romantic partner, again, you get the perfect spouse for you, the perfect person with whom to share your life, but you can't ever experience anyone else. And everyone says, well, you can see the numbers yourself. Most people say they don't take the deal. They say they don't take the deal. And then when I ask them why, most people, in my experience at Pace, is most people say that, or let's say with New York City, young New York City, men and women, most people say that, most people think that taking the deal is a loss of personal freedom. Most people say that I am less free, I have less autonomy if I accept the movies being selected for me, and the jobs being selected for me, and the partner being selected for me. However, you can see a significant percentage, I mean, that's at least 10% and up to 20%, that's significant, they say, look, yes, I will give up my autonomy and my freedom. I don't want choices if I can get happiness, pleasure, convenience, right? If I can get the right movies without worrying about it. If I can get the perfect job for me, if I can get the perfect partner, those are big rewards, especially the latter two. And those are really big things. If you can maximize those kinds of happiness, are you willing to give up your self-determination? Are you willing to give up your freedom? That makes a lot of sense to me. Most people you can see, most New York City young people do not want to do that. I understand that when you're young, you want to experiment. Of course, true. But I understand also that the 20% or the 10% or the 15% there, that's a big reward. And so the question is, will you trade your freedom for happiness? Will you trade your ability to determine for yourself what movies to watch, what job to have, which partner to have in order to get the right movie, the right job, the right partner? It's a hard question. But it begins to round out our understanding of what the value of autonomy is. Remember, we're trying to not just define it in some technical sense, which we've done. It's important. But we're also trying to understand it in some human sense. What does autonomy feel like? What will we trade for it? What's worth having? What's more worth having? And I think here there's a pretty, what's being revealed here is there's a fairly clear trade-off between personal freedom, your ability to experiment with different movies, jobs, partners, and something like happiness. So what's worth more, freedom or happiness? And you can see if that's the choice, and I know that's the choice on the exam because I ask people, well, which one do you want and why? And what people say overwhelmingly is, what most people say is they want the freedom because it's worth more than happiness. But a fair number of people say, look, happiness, contentment, getting the right thing, that's worth more than freedom. So you can decide for yourself. And then just quickly, to bring this back down to earth, that's all very abstract, but there's also a practical element to what's going on here. In the European Union, and this appears to be true generally, as regulations and laws are being deployed, forgetting the term for exactly what promulgated, yes, when the laws are being promulgated, divisions are being drawn between high risk and medium risk and low risk artificial intelligence systems, which basically means kind of the Tinder, LinkedIn, Netflix distinction. Most governing agencies, what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, look, for stuff like Netflix, Spotify, we don't need to put a lot of regulations onto AI. We don't need to put a lot of protections. People can decide for themselves. They want to use those tools. And even if people sort of get tricked into watching Netflix show after show, you know, Netflix ends up just telling them what they want to watch. It's really not a big deal. So we don't need to worry too much about that. Forget it. Then as we get up toward medical things, and maybe the LinkedIn experiment would be in the medium risk or limited to high risk, right? It's more important in our lives. Well, in that those areas, then we have some, at least the current thinking is that we should have some more rules and some more regulations to decide. This is always just a question in political theory for our overlords in Washington, D.C., or Brussels, or Paris, or Rome, or what have you, for our overlords to tell us, you know, what we can and can't do, and can and can't see, and can't and can't say, and so on. It seems like that the thinking, the mainstream thinking now is that there are some medium risk things where the government should prohibit or severely limit your ability as a user to make your own decision about whether or not you use certain devices and things. And maybe that might be LinkedIn or something like that. And perhaps the rules are that that you're prohibited from using these things, but instead that there are all kinds of permissions that must be sought and all kinds of limitations that are placed upon the companies. Maybe those are good things. Maybe they're not. Probably a mix. Have to decide for yourselves as time goes on. And then at the highest level, there's unacceptable risk. Those are areas where at least some governments believe that citizens should not have any rights at all to make a decision about artificial intelligence, and companies should not have any rights at all to even deploy these kinds of artificial intelligence. One of those areas is social scoring and facial recognition. We're going to talk more about those things later, but what I'm trying to say here, and the reason I'm bringing this up is, well, there's two reasons. One, because I thought it was time to make sure that we see that this stuff that we're talking about, it does connect with the real world, and the laws that are being promulgated are being promulgated with these ideas in mind that we're talking about now, with this idea that autonomy, maybe it means more in some areas of experience than others. Maybe we should say that it matters if LinkedIn or Tinder is taking away from our personal freedom, but maybe who cares if Netflix does that, or maybe not. I mean, I think that you can certainly disagree. Of course you can disagree with the way governments today are dividing up, or the way they're thinking about regulating artificial intelligence. And many people do disagree. Many people say, look, that's just not the way we should be thinking about it. We'll have to see how all this pans out. But what's important for this class is that you understand that that's the question that is being asked. Right? The question is, citizens' autonomy, personal freedom, self-determination should be protected, even if it means that they're denied the right to use certain things. So it should be protected. And the question is, when should it be protected? Always, sometimes, in some categories, or not. It's going to be a very hard decision. It's going to be very difficult to get this right. And certainly, there will be a lot of errors on the way. The technology is advancing very rapidly. So it's hard to know beforehand which technologies are going to legitimately help us be more free, and which technologies are going to subtract from our freedom, subtract from the choices we have. We will have to see as time goes on. Okay, so that's the questions to stop at and consider for a moment now. The question is, how is autonomy? Is autonomy one of those things which is like sand? That is, you can have a lot of it or a little of it. And in that case, there are some areas where it's more important, some areas where it's less important. Maybe it's important for Tinder and LinkedIn, but not important for Netflix. Or by contrast, is autonomy more like a one and a zero, or pregnancy? You either have it or you don't. In which case, we should be equally worried about autonomy, whether we're talking about Netflix or talking about a lifetime partner. I'm not sure. Okay, so we'll take 5 minutes to think about that. And then we go on to the question of exploit. All right, exploit. What is this all about? The big idea here is what we are discussing is algorithm design to maximize human autonomy. And the area of our discussion is that this notion of explore exploit, which is also discussed in the literature as one-armed bandits. So what is a one-armed bandit? Well, that's a one-armed bandit, for those of you who've never been to Las Vegas, is the machine where you drop a quarter in and then you pull the handle and it rolls and gives you three pineapples or something. And if it gets three pineapples, you get a dollar back. And if it's a pineapple and two hammers, you get a quarter back. And if it's a pineapple and a hammer and something else, you get nothing back. And if it's three crowns, then you win $1 million and that kind of thing. Right. So you can just sit there and put quarters in and play. That's a one-armed bandit. And the explore exploit dilemma is something that anyone who's ever visited Las Vegas and just experimented with those machines knows. If you put in, you get $10 worth of quarters, let's say, and you start plucking them into the machine and you get nothing. And you hear the people next to you, they're getting winnings and the quarters are pouring out of the machine and happiness and you're just nothing. Then you're caught in the explore exploit question. And this is the question. The question is, look, on the one side, you might say, this machine is just bad luck for me. This machine is not going to work for me. I've just put $5 worth of quarters in. I've gotten nothing. So I better switch machines and try and find one that works better for me. That's explore, right? I'll try this machine for a while. I'll try that machine for a while. Try this other machine for a while. Or maybe I will go from one-armed bandits. I will now try blackjack or try the lottery wheel or something, right? Try to keep changing what I'm playing until I find something where I start to win. That's explore. But exploit, by contrast, is the idea that, well, you find something that works for you and you just stick with it. And once you've plucked in $5 worth of quarters into this machine, well, then you've made this big investment in the machine and you think, look, I mean, I should exploit this investment. A win has got to come up soon, right? It's five times four, so it's $5 times four, right? So it's 20 quarters that I've lost. There's in the next 10 quarters, there's got to be a win here, right? So that's exploit. So explore is the idea, you know, that where you kind of look around and try to find the blackjack or the one-armed bandit or the thing that works for you. It's when you're looking for jobs, it's explore is when you try to find, you try to be an insurance salesman, then a lawyer, then this, then that. That's explore. Exploit is when you say, I'm just going to stick with one thing and try and get all I can out of this. As you might do if you say, I decide my career is philosophy, so I'm going to just keep doing philosophy year after year, even if I have some bad years when no publications or something, I'll just keep doing it, and have confidence that over the long run it will work out for me. That's exploit. So I plugged into DALL-E, two people playing one-armed bandit slot machines in Las Vegas casino. They're next to each other. Their faces are visible. One person is envious. One person is joyful because he wins a big pot. Or she, well, he wins. Looks like it's a woman who won the big pot. And then there's the guy back there who's all frustrated. That's the explore-exploit dilemma, right? The guy in the background sees this woman is overjoyed. And you can see this is earlier days of DALL-E's from 2022. So the image is not very good. The woman looks, you know, kind of like a crazy woman, and the guy looks also kind of like a crazy man. They both look crazy. But it captures the idea, right? And the poor guys are plucking his quarters in, and the woman is like happy because she just keeps winning the winnings. And so the guy's tempted, look, do I explore? Do I look for a different machine, or do I just stick with this one where I put all my money in? That's explore exploit. And now I'm asking, how does that connect with, I've said how it connects with one-armed bandits. I'm asking, how does it connect with serendipity and how does it connect with autonomy? And that's what we will look at next. We're sticking with the Netflix example. And this is a real example. This is kind of the Netflix challenge. As a business, it's the behavioral challenge, not necessarily the ethical challenge. It's the idea Netflix, as we've said, they want you to stick with their platform. They want you to watch show after show after show with them. And they know what you want, right? This is the exploit. After you've watched 10 episodes of Poirot, and there's 10 more episodes left, well, they know what you like. So they do not need to offer you different shows or something. They don't need to explore with other interests. They know your interest. So they exploit that, and they just keep offering you more Poirot, 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 until it runs out of Poirot, right? But now, once Poirot runs out, that's when you get the explore-exploit question. The explore-exploit question is, it's just like the one-armed bandit. Should Netflix give you another show which is just like Poirot or very similar? Or should they try to give you something which is a little crazy, a little off the wall? Instead of a detective movie, maybe kind of an action-adventure like Mission Impossible or Die Hard or some Superman or Spider-Man or something like that. And it's really hard for Netflix to know that. On the one hand, if they keep exploiting, if Netflix keeps showing you series and movies and videos and streaming that is really like the last thing you've seen, at some point you become bored, right? And then you leave Netflix. You say, look, they keep showing me, first it's Mission Impossible, and then it's Die Hard, and then it's another one about a kidnapping and Liam Nelson or something, and they're all kind of the same. There's always some innocent person is taken away, and then some person has to come rescue them with crazy secret skills or something. And it's great for the first 5 or 10 movies, but after a while, you just get tired of it. So if Netflix keeps exploiting, if they keep showing you the same thing over and over again, then they lose you as a viewer. So they want to give you something which is similar to what you've seen, but again, they don't want to go too far. So that's exploit. Explore, on the other hand, for Netflix is, as I say, when they show you something which is completely off the wall, when they show you something which is completely different than what you have seen before. And so that might be, if you've been watching these detective movies, it might be all of a sudden they switch up and they give you a documentary about a jazz musician or something. I'm not sure. And then you watch that. Let's say they give you a documentary for a jazz musician. And you watch that for 12 seconds. You say, no, forget it. Turn the TV off. Well, Netflix learned something there, right? Netflix learned, they explored, and they learned jazz is not for you. So they're not going to give you another jazz recommendation. So you turn it back on again, they're probably going to go back to exploit, and they're going to show you something like the movies you'd previously enjoyed. But when those run, or when those run out, or when they sense that you might be getting bored, they're going to have to, sooner or later, they're going to have to explore again. They're going to have to try to show you something which is different to see if they can find some new interest to tempt you, to get you involved in something else to watch. And so if they gave you a documentary about a jazz singer, that was a failure. Then maybe they gave you a romance. I'm just making this up. Maybe they give you a romantic comedy with Sandra Bullock or something, or Meg Ryan as a new one, or the Barbie movie or the Oppenheimer, whatever is different than what you've been looking at recently. So once again, the process repeats. And do you just turn the TV off immediately? Or do you sit through and watch the movie for 5 minutes, 10 minutes? You watch the whole thing to the end. Netflix learns from that. And they are constantly involved in this game, this back and forth between, on the one hand, using the knowledge they have about you to give you programs that they are 99% sure you will like. And on the other hand, exploring, trying to find new things that you will like, because they know that if they keep giving you the same thing over and over again, you believe. So they have to find new things. But the cost of finding new things is that if you don't like it, then you also leave. So, I mean, Netflix is a hard time. If they give you the same thing over and over again, you leave. If they give you something which is too different, you also leave. They have to find exactly the right spot. They have to find something which is sufficiently different than what you're used to keep you interested, to keep you attuned, but something that's also similar enough to what you've seen, so you don't just turn it off in disgust. You know, just turn it off and say, this is too weird, too different for me. So that's the explore-exploit dilemma in what's called predictive analytics. Predictive analytics is just the general idea that you will be recommended something that fits you. It doesn't matter whether the recommendation is a movie to watch or a job to have or a partner to marry or anything, or music to listen to or anything. Predictive analytics is just the idea that data and algorithms can be used to give you the next happy choice. But as I say, everyone who does predictive analytics is caught in this explore-exploit dilemma. On the one hand, how many times can you give someone the same thing that they've already had and keep them happy? And to what extent can you explore? How frequently can you show them something completely different and not have them leave the platform and never come back? Terrifically difficult human challenge. And that then is, in a certain sense, a way of, at least what I'm proposing here, is it's a way of maximizing autonomy. If you can find the right balance between explore and exploit, then on the one hand, right, you are providing the reward of autonomy, of self-determination. You are letting people choose for themselves what they want and enjoy that choice when they're watching another episode of Poirot. But you're not completely trapping them in that, because you are showing them occasionally some new thing. So the person who's watching Netflix constantly has the opportunity to determine for themselves what they want to watch. Something like that is, it seems to me, is the way that a platform would maximize autonomy. On the one hand, they're trying to maximize self-determination. So on the one hand, they have to give you what you determine you want, the kind of movie you like. But they can't just take away the process of applying that law to yourself, so that in that sense, they have to occasionally feed you things where you once again exercise the ability to choose for yourself. Do I want this? Do I not want this? So something like that is the way it seems like autonomy will work for Netflix. And of course, I just use Netflix as an example because it's non-controversial. We could use it for other things too. But I just want to talk about this purely rationally, and no one gets too emotional about Netflix. So that's why I'm using this example. But the theory that we're developing here applies to Match or to LinkedIn or to religious kinds of things or political kinds of things and all the other stuff too. It's the same. It's the same dynamic. It's just different domain. So we are at the Netflix behavioral challenge, and we've said there's this balance between explore and exploit, that they want to keep you on platform. And now what I'm saying is that there's also a kind of an accompanying ethics challenge. And that is that you could maximize autonomy, and that's what I just got done saying, right? That maybe these two challenges, maybe you could conceive them as fitting together, right? That you can both maximize the behavior, the amount of time people spend looking at Netflix, the viewing time watched, and also maximize the viewer's autonomy if you balance explore and exploit well, right? People are constantly getting what they want, but they're also constantly reinforcing their own ability to decide for themselves. So I think that makes sense. And then that connects with, I want to talk now about something very specific for AI engineers and designers and people involved in computer science. The idea of serendipity is at least at the moment, these things change every 2 weeks, but at the moment, the idea of serendipity is the field of study, which is occupied with finding this balance between explore and exploit. Serendipity is the idea that Netflix will help you stumble upon some interesting kind of movie that will engage you, and that you will be able to decide for yourself that you like, and you want to watch more movies that are like that, or more series which are like that. So serendipity is, of course, just as a dictionary definition, serendipity is to have the lucky chance that you stumble upon something you like, right? The kind of music or so on. What predictive analytics does is it uses algorithms to make you to increase your serendipity, to make you serendipitous. Have your days be serendipitous. That's right. Serendipitous is the word. We want your days to be serendipitous, meaning that you stumble upon, via the algorithms and the training of the artificial intelligence, you stumble upon things which are new and different, but also interesting and engaging, right? So it's that balance between an explore and exploit. And so serendipity, if you want to work at Netflix and you're interested in what I'm saying right now, you can study serendipity and they will definitely hire you at Netflix or other places, because this is a big, big business concern. I mean, how can we keep users on site without losing them? Because on one side they get bored, or on the other side they don't get things that are interesting. You've got to change up what they want, but keep it interesting at the same time. It's really hard to do. Serendipity. And we can think about this analytically in some sense. There's this algorithm designed to maximize autonomy, but this could also be to maximize serendipity. And you can at least, or I can't tell you how to get it right, but I can help you sort of frame the question. And you can see that sort of for explore, exploit, if you are trying to lengthen user engagement from zero to infinity, right? In some sense, Netflix wants you to be there watching infinitely. Or the same thing, if you're trying to go from zero to infinite profit for Netflix, or if you're trying to go from zero to infinite enjoyment for the user, I'm certain that all those things can be mapped onto an explore-exploit axis, and that if you're at maximum explore, right, if you're purely explore, as you are at this extreme, then you're going to have pretty much zero user enjoyment, zero profit, and zero user engagement, because you're just essentially just constantly giving people completely new things. So they say, well, why would I use the Netflix predictive algorithm? Because it's just giving me new things all the time. I never have a chance to actually kind of enjoy over a period of time the sort of film that I like. So if you have pure explore, if it's just constantly different things coming at you, then you're going to get no enjoyment, no profit, and no user engagement. But the same thing is true at the other extreme, right? Maybe it's not immediate, but if you just keep showing someone the same thing over and over and over and over again, their enjoyment is going to diminish to zero. They're going to leave the platform, so profit goes to zero, and they're going to leave the platform, so engagement also goes to zero. So you can see that enjoyment for the user, profit for the platform, and user engagement all is at zero when you're pure explore, pure exploit. But it moves up toward infinity, never gets there. It moves up as you move along this curve, as you get this balance between explore and exploit. The hard point is, or the difficulty, and what you're looking for, is the top of the curve there. Now, what is that point? How do you balance explore and exploit? And also, is that balancing point, is it the same for profit for the platform as it is for user engagement, as it is, most importantly, for user enjoyment? If you're a Netflix user, is your enjoyment as a user going to occur at the same point as the maximum profit for Netflix? Is the curve identical, or at least the top point of the curve, is it identical for those two things? And there's a lot of factors that come in there, right? Because you've got to think about also Netflix pays different amounts of money to the producers to show Poirot versus show Shetland versus show something else. So it's extraordinarily complicated. You need artificial intelligence to figure all that out, right? I don't think they have figured it out even with artificial intelligence, but you can at least understand, conceptualize the problem. And this is what the problem looks like. It's this curve between explore and exploit. If you have pure explore and no exploit, you're at zero. If you have pure exploit and no explore, you end up at zero. What is the balance? How do you maximize that, one? And two, is that point of maximization, is it the same or similar for user enjoyment and platform profitability? Not sure. So that's the That's the Netflix challenge. If you're interested in this kind of field and you're in computer science, then one area where you might want to investigate this is in the literature on breaking filter bubbles in social media. You probably know that filter bubbles is this idea that, especially in TikTok, it's very powerful, but it tends to happen generally in social media that when you express an interest in something, and people talk a lot about this in politics because it's a fairly obvious case, so I will just stick with that. When you express an interest in, let's say you express an interest, we'll take a kind of off the, not one of the main candidates, but let's say that, I'm not sure how to pronounce the name, kind of an idiosyncratic candidate, the Ramaswamy person, younger guy with everyone agrees, some interesting ideas. Some people like them, some people don't like them, but he certainly has interesting ideas. And so what the platforms do is, and if you kind of like his ideas, then it will show you more videos in TikTok or, you know, connect you with more friends who also like his ideas. So it tends to push you into kind of liking him in an extreme way. Why? Because the machine has localized this kind of interest you have in this person. And so you get the feedback you get is positive about him, and that leads you to like him more, which leads to more positive feedback, and you go deeply into, you become a unstoppable right, Ramaswamy advocate. Or again, you could just choose if you want to go the other direction on the political ideology, that's fine. Same examples, other way, it works perfectly well. Or in music, it would be the same thing, right? You start with, I'm just making something up, 1990s alternative, like grunge music, like Nirvana or something, and you like that, and they start feeding you other music which is like Nirvana, and your social media connects you with other friends who also like Nirvana, and they say, look, this band Soundgarden is like Nirvana, so listen to that, and before you know it, after a few weeks on the site, you end up, your whole life is just surrounded by 90s alternative rock stuff. Right, that's the music you listen to, that's the friends you have, and so on. So that's what a filter bubble is in social media. It's this idea, whether it's Facebook or Spotify or anything that brings people together and around some interest. As soon as you express an interest in something and the algorithm pushes you in that direction, it does tend to reinforce that interest and you get more and more extreme. What makes TikTok so powerful is that it does that very rapidly and very effectively. Some people like that TikTok does that. Some people don't like that TikTok does that. We're going to talk about that later in a different part of the seminar. But for the moment, the question that's being raised there is, when this happens, when you get sucked into these filter bubbles, is your autonomy increasing or decreasing? And you can maybe see kind of an answer, at least according to this graph, right? You would say, look, your autonomy increases maybe for a while as you move from explore to exploit, as you discover the first video of 90s alternative rock, and then the second and the third. And so you're going up the curve, you know, toward a maximum autonomy. But then when you find you've been listening to the same song over and over again for a week, right? Then you're in the exploit phase, then your autonomy is disappearing, right? So if you want to maximize autonomy in predictive analytics, right, you might look at the literature on filter bubbles and how some people are trying to break those bubbles or trying to introduce new interests to people within the same general kind of domain. So if it's a musical Spotify, let's say a musical platform, work on bursting filter bubbles is essentially work on exploring. It's work on trying to find ways, or is also work on serendipity. It's work on trying to find ways to get users interested in new kinds of music so they don't get trapped in that one kind of bubble of everything being the same. Okay. You can ask yourselves, just take a few minutes and ask, just from your own experience and your own work in this area, you know, how might you maximize user autonomy? What would be an area that you're familiar with? Maybe you're familiar with musical platforms or something else. I'm not sure each of you will have your own area of work in computer science. Please just think of some area that you work in or that you know someone who works in. It doesn't matter. Some area of work in computer science, and think about what the autonomy challenge is there. And what I've been trying to show on one hand is what autonomy is, but on the other hand, what I've been trying to show is where this question of autonomy comes into real applications in computer science today. Right? And that's why I'm talking about explore, exploit, and serendipity, and filter bubbles, and so on. So what I'm asking you to do here is take what we've learned, one, about autonomy, and two, about how that ethical abstract idea actually happens in the world of computer science. Take those two things that we've done, and then think for yourself a little bit about your own domain of experience in computer science, what kind of projects you work on and do, and think for yourself, well, how does autonomy, the question of autonomy, I mean, how does it exist in the domain in which I am working? And maybe it doesn't exist. I mean, not everything happens everywhere, right? But if it does, maybe you could outline how it does and why it does and what kind of steps someone might take if they were going to try to maximize autonomy in that area. Just like we said for Netflix, right? If you're going to try to maximize user autonomy, you want to try to do work in serendipity. You want to try to do work in ways of tempting users with new movies or shows they will like, but doing it well, right? Giving them things that are different than what they've already had, but things they will actually like and want to watch, not just giving them things that are different and make them turn off the TV. So that's how it works in Netflix. And what I'm asking you to think about is how it would work in your area of computer science.